Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. We've been covering the Israel-Palestine conflict for the last few weeks in the same manner that we covered the U.S. war against Russia in Ukraine, by offering viewpoints and perspectives largely omitted by the mainstream media. We did this in the lead-up to the U.S. assaults on Iraq and Afghanistan, and independent media's coverage helped turn public opinion against those wars, which history now records as having been unjust. So we see this as our job here in community radio. If you want to find detailed, unbiased accounts of the U.S., of the history of Israel's expansion within Palestine, per se, and the plight of the Palestinian people, you'll most likely find it here, as we're not beholden to governments or financiers with a bias exerting sensorial editorial control. Yet, if you speak critically of Israel, or even spell Palestine with a capital P, it seems, Zionists will rush to accuse you of anti-Semitism and of siding with Hamas, the quasi-government entity in Gaza that has a history of staging terrorist attacks against Israel. I recall once a call-in show in Columbus on the NPR affiliate WOSU, hosted by the solidly fair and neutral Fred Anderle, got picketed by busloads of Zionists from a tri-state area just because he interviewed a Palestinian. The actor Mayim Bialik, who is a regular character on The Big Bang Theory, recently posted a video in which she accused anti-Zionists of calling for a genocide against Jews at protest rallies both in Pennsylvania and at her alma mater, UCLA. I looked it up, of course, and that never happened. UCLA issued a statement regarding both protests, correcting Bialik's misinformation. The rallies were calling for a ceasefire, and the chant was, "We charge you with genocide," not "We want a Jewish genocide." How out of touch was Bialik to assume that any rally of any size in the U.S. would actually be calling for a genocide of anyone, let alone choosing such an awkwardly worded chant? Maybe Bialik hasn't generally attended social justice rallies or been involved. Anyway, despite the universities having debunked her claim, her video is still up. She has not issued a correction. And to a large extent, that is the job that falls to us, thanks in part to propagandists like Bialik or Joe Scarborough or even President Biden, all of whom present a very one-sided and incomplete picture aimed at rallying support for further violence, such as we're witnessing now in Israel as Palestine as Israel reduces Gaza to rubble, over 9,000 Palestinians killed, a third of them children. During the Nixon administration, there was a chant that the whole world is watching. Well, I wonder. It seems like here in the U.S. we're watching through an exceedingly narrow lens. One news outlet that has been consistent in presenting the information and perspectives omitted by most others is, of course, Democracy Now!, whose host and creator, Amy Goodman, was in Charleston, West Virginia recently at the Grassroots Radio Coalition annual gathering. Our own Eugene Beer was there and recorded her speech.
It is an honor to be here to introduce Amy Goodman.
I really want to thank Damon Cater for his flexibility and his work and everyone here at WTSQ in Charleston. Community radio, everyone who helped to organize the Grassroots Radio Conference. I have so much respect for keeping this network of community and college and low power FM, community radio outlets all over the country, connecting the dots of local voices who are so important to be heard. You know, instead of that small circle of pundits we get on the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. And that is so serious today in the midst of what's happening with Israel-Palestine, because the lies take lives. The work you do is so important. And there is no time that tells us this more than today. At a global level, we have so much to learn from independent media. I also want to thank my colleague, Dennis Moynihan. I work with him at Democracy Now! We also write a column together every week that appears in newspapers and websites around the world. In the last few weeks, we have written several columns. The first, as Israel levels Gaza, the U.S. media fuels the fire. That's right. As Israel intensifies its brutal response to Hamas's brutal October 7th attack, it's important to hear from those at the target end of the weapons. The mainstream media in the United States consistently brings us the voices of Israelis who've suffered violence at the hands of Hamas gunmen. Let that be a model for the coverage of Palestinian pain as well. We rarely hear from Palestinian civilians, from Israeli peace activists. Hearing people speak for themselves is the first step to breaking down barriers, to fostering understanding that can lead to a just and enduring peace. I originally come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded how many decades ago? Almost 80 years ago, by a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California, and his allies, who was a war resistor, came out of the detention camps after World War II, and said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by journalists, that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. That's how Pacifica was born. As George Gerbner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications and founder of the cultural environment movement, would say, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. So KPFA was the first Pacifica station, born in 1949 in Berkeley, California. 10 years later, KPFK. I was just pitching on KPFK yesterday on the way to the airport on the phone. Yes, please go to kpfk.org as we were bringing out the voices of people in Israel and Palestine that you are not hearing but should be hearing everywhere else. But amazingly, because of the incredible network of grassroots radio and television around this country and around the world, was heard right here on WTSQ. KPFK went on the air in 1959-60. Then my station, WBAI in New York, went on the air in 1960. KPFT in Houston, Texas in 1970, and WPFW in Washington, the youngest of the Pacifica Five, the Fab Five, went on the air in 1977. I want to talk about Houston for a second. 1970, KPFT goes on the air. Within a few weeks, it was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. They strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. KPFT got back on their feet, rebuilt the transmitter a few weeks later, went back on the air, and then the Klan strapped 15 times the dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it up again, right in the middle, I think it was, of Arlo Guthrie singing Ellis's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. But it would then take months for KPFT to rebuild the transmitter. And in January of 1971, Guthrie came back into Houston live to finish his song live on the air. And the national media was there to cover this phoenix rising from the ashes. And it's been broadcasting ever since. I can't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. I think because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is, dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, a child in Rafah, a grandma in Haifa, an uncle in Ramallah, a human rights lawyer in Gaza City, when you hear someone's aunt speaking from Jerusalem, when you hear a great-grandfather speaking in Afghanistan or a great-grandma in Iraq, it changes you. You may not agree with what you hear. I mean, how many times do we agree with our family members? In fact, that uncle that you're listening to, you may hate the uncle he reminds you of, but somehow you identify with them. You understand where they are coming from. And that understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media all too often has acted as a weapon of war. And there's no time more relevant to this point than today in the Middle East. Whether it's direct lies or omissions, the voices you are not hearing. And that's why grassroots media is so absolutely critical. Not long after the Hamas attack, Israel began its latest intense bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Bearing the full force of that retaliation are the more than 2 million Palestinians who Israel's blockaded in Gaza, almost half of whom are children. The Gaza Strip, roughly 4 miles wide and 25 miles long, is one of the most densely populated places on earth, has long been described by human rights organizations and Israeli intelligence officials as an open-air prison. Under normal so-called conditions, Gazans live under severe military occupation. No one gets in or out without Israel's permission. Israel controls Gaza's water, food, and fuel. Now, in the wake of the attack, the Israeli siege and bombardment of Gaza has become cataclysmic. What did the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant just say? We are imposing a complete siege in Gaza. There will be no food, no water, no fuel. Everything will be closed. We're fighting against human animals, the Israeli Defense Minister said. So what is the result of this attitude? A Palestinian child is dying every 15 minutes. 100 Palestinian children are dying every day. Who first said that on Democracy Now! In this last week? It was Sari Bashi. She's a top official with Human Rights Watch, and she happens to live in Ramallah in the West Bank. And you might say, well, Ramallah, the West Bank, Israeli-occupied territory, is not the same as Gaza. It's not. But they are killing so many Palestinians there as well. Hamas does not control the occupied West Bank. And yet, since the beginning of this year, since way before that brutal Hamas attack on October 7th that killed over 1,300 Israelis, and they took, it looks like, more than 200 hostages, two American hostages, a mom and her daughter, were just released. I saw that last night when I came back from your event. In this last year, since January, more than a Palestinian a day on the West Bank has been killed by Israeli soldiers or settlers. So we have to understand this was happening way before October 7th. And when you hear those say, do not try to justify, I agree. But context is not justification. Context is understanding what is happening so we can change the situation. And that involves everyone. It particularly involves us in the United States because the U.S. is the most powerful country on earth. We have an awesome responsibility here to speak to our government of how we want our resources to be used, what we want done in our name. Whether it has an effect or not, it is our job, whether we are journalists or everyday civilians. So the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, says we're imposing a complete siege in Gaza. There will be no food, no water, no fuel. Everything will be closed. We are fighting against human animals. And how did the former Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, respond to a Sky News anchor, who said, what about the Palestinian civilians? Notice I wasn't talking about an American anchor, a Sky News, a British news anchor. What about the Palestinian civilians? And Naftali Bennett lost it. He said, his voice got loud, and he said, are you seriously asking me about Palestinian civilians right now? Yes, it's absolutely critical we understand who is on the ground. And in the case of Gaza and the occupied territories, I was just watching an Israeli government official saying, why should we have to be responsible for them anyway? Well, the fact is, they are. They are responsible under international law because they have illegally occupied them for decades. So until that ends, they have a responsibility to protect them. And instead, one child every 15 minutes, one Palestinian child is dying. 100 children are dying a day, and Israel hasn't even begun its massive ground assault, if it does do that. We don't know at this point, although someone may have news as I'm speaking right now. And that's where the world weighs in. Right now, there is a so-called peace summit going on in Egypt. We will see what happens. Raji Sarani, director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza and winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award, said on Democracy Now, there is no single place you can call a safe haven in Gaza. Airplane fighters, drones ruling all over the sky, whether it's an apartment, whether it's a tower with hundreds of apartments, whether it's a house, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a school or a shelter used by UNRWA. That's the UN's Palestinian Relief Agency, he said. He spoke as his house shook from an explosion. We learned that the Islamic University had just been bombed right down the road. He says, Netanyahu says, Gazans should leave Gaza. Where to? We don't have safe passage. It's genocidal. We were talking to Raji on Skype. You could actually see him. You know, you on the radio, listen. And we are the first TV radio broadcast, daily global grassroots broadcast for the last 27 years. But sometimes if you want to go to democracynow.org or your local public access or PBS station, Democracy Now! Might be on, you could see Raji. He said, do you hear my house shaking? That was the first time we talked to Raji 2 weeks ago. We had spoken to him long before. He's come to the United States, has won every human rights award, world-renowned human rights lawyer. That was 2 weeks ago. And then we spoke to him for the second time a week ago, because I had just seen a letter that he had written. This was last Monday. He shared this message with his friends. Good morning from Gaza, the most wonderful city I loved and wished to end my life on its soil. Terrible and unbelievable, the criminality. We did not sleep from the bombing. Freedom and dignity so costly, we're ready to pay our lives for it. No right to give up. I am so proud of my people. Unbelievable courage and strength. Keep the strategic optimism, love, and hugs to you all, my friends. We immediately called him and spoke to him. Now, no longer Skype. He doesn't have the power, the electricity. But we were able to make out what he said on the phone. And we played that for about half an hour. You can read the transcript at Democracy Now! And then, as we got up this morning, I got a text from a colleague that Raji Sarani's house has been bombed. He lives in Gaza City, right? That's in the north. That's the main population center of Gaza, right? The main population center of one of the most densely populated places on earth. The Israeli military has said all the people of northern Gaza must move to southern Gaza. We're talking about 1.1 million people. The UN said this is impossible. How do you expect the people, for example, from the hospitals, people who are unconscious, the doctors and nurses who are treating people there, how do they move south? What we are talking about, folks, is the illegal act of collective punishment. We do not accept this anywhere. So I got word that Raji's house had been bombed. And then I started to write around, and I got more and more texts. Chantal Maloney, a great Italian human rights lawyer, just tweeted, "He and his family are alive. They're disconnected, but I'm in contact with other people in Gaza. On the 7th of October, he told us, 'I know they will massacre us.' Raji Sarani spent his life defending the rule of law against the rule of jungle. He is a human rights champion, a true hero." To which Reed Brody, longtime Human Rights Watch, a lawyer, activist, going after dictators around the world, said, "More tragedy," as he heard about the bombing of Raji's house. "I'm told Raji Sarani and his family fortunately are alive. Raji is simply one of the most precious human beings. A beacon of light." And then a beautiful picture of Raji. This is what's happening in Gaza. If this was the home of an Israeli human rights lawyer that was bombed by Hamas, I would be the first to condemn it. This is the home of a Palestinian human rights lawyer. You know, Sweet Honey in the Rock has a wonderful song, and they're celebrating, I think it's their 50th anniversary coming up. And the song goes something like, "Until the killing of black men, black women's sons, is equal to the killing of white men, white mothers' sons." And that's what I keep on thinking about through this time. I speak to you as a journalist, as a Jewish journalist, as the granddaughter of an Orthodox rabbi. And growing up, the Holocaust was very much the context of our lives. And all of us, me and my brothers, my cousins, my aunts and uncles, I think we imbibed the what was more than a slogan, "Never again." That "never again" applies to everyone, everywhere. That is something that has really influenced every way I see the world and our role in the world. Never again. And it's our job as journalists to go to where the silence is. The next time you look at CNN, with all of their hosts, all of their anchors, so many of them right now in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, look how many are in Gaza. They do have a Gazan reporter, a Palestinian reporter. You don't hear him live. He is fleeing with his family from north to south, and he's trying to document that journey. And occasionally CNN plays it. It is so utterly powerful. He takes his two little kids and his wife, and they're driving south, and he says, "We're going into a hotel." He doesn't want to make his kids afraid. And his son says to him, "But do they bomb the hotels?" And he said, "Absolutely not." And then he says to the camera, "I have to say this to my son." He's so distraught. And then they felt it wasn't safe even to be at that hotel, and they left there, and there was a bombing right next to the hotel right as they were leaving. And then the next time I saw him, he said, "I'm giving my children toilet water. I am giving my children toilet water to drink." That's the exception on CNN. The rule is all of the anchors that you're so familiar with being there, reporting outside of Gaza, interviewing so many of the victims of October 7th, again, as they should. But we need to use that as a model of the victims right now in Gaza, because a war crime is being committed as we speak, unfolding every day. Oh, you know, we brought you on Democracy Now! Ofer Kassif, an Israeli Jewish member of the Knesset. That's the Israeli parliament. He said, "I got a WhatsApp message from a very good friend of mine who was hiding with her husband in the kibbutz. She told me she was very afraid and she could hear the Hamas fighters outside. Unfortunately, those were probably the last words she ever wrote, because she was murdered. And her husband, just after she sent me that message, MP Ofer Kassif said to us. Her husband, she was murdered with her husband just after she sent me that message. She was a very good friend of mine who was also against the occupation. Innocent people, innocent civilians on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, pay the price of the arrogant, criminal, ongoing occupation that Israel refuses to end, he said, an Israeli Jewish member of parliament. Did you hear their voice on the corporate networks? No, but on all of your grassroots stations, you heard it as you play Democracy Now. I just read that Ofer Kassif has been sanctioned by the parliament. He has been suspended for his criticism. And that's another issue. Until now, and this may change, and you should demand, because the airwaves are the public airwaves, they are yours too, whether the corporations are using them or you are, the word occupation, how important it is to understand that context. Yes, U.S. networks have dispatched correspondents to Israel to cover the violence, but there are few Palestinians being interviewed or Israeli peace activists or reporters who've been documenting that occupation for decades. We also spoke to Rashid Khalidi, a preeminent Palestinian-American historian and scholar. He's the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. We've had him on several times on Democracy Now! In the last few weeks, his family from the occupied West Bank. He lives in New York. He said the idea that you can coop up 5 million people, put them behind walls, tighten the siege on them, use an eyedropper to allow them some food, some water, some electricity, that idea has exploded as a result of the horrific events. This cannot continue, he said. An eyedropper for millions of people. And just as we gathered here today, you may have heard that the Rafah border was opened for 20 trucks. This was negotiated for more than a week. 20 trucks, humanitarian trucks that have medicine, that have some food. Israel said they could not contain fuel. The human rights organizations, Doctors Without Borders, and the Palestinian Red Crescent and the International Red Cross all said the number one thing they need is fuel to run the hospitals that are barely operating. They allowed in 20 trucks and then closed it. Do you know how many trucks of humanitarian aid have been coming into this occupied population before this siege? It has been under an almost total siege, actually, for 16 years. 400 trucks a day. How long do you think that 20 trucks of humanitarian aid will go? As I heard one humanitarian worker say, even 100 trucks a day would be far from sufficient right now. So we cannot forget this. Professor Khalidi said, the United States should be trying to defuse the situation. We finance this occupation. We finance this violence. There are American weapons that are being used today, right now in Gaza, to kill innocent civilians in violation of U.S. law, Professor Khalidi said. Yes, the United States does have the power to pressure Israel to end its occupation of Gaza, of the West Bank, and Jerusalem. But first, the media must allow the American public to hear the voices of the victims. You will be changed, no matter who that victim is. We have to be able to hear Raji. We have to be able to hear all of those voices. That is what self-determination and empowerment is all about. This week, Dennis and I wrote a column called Ceasefire in Gaza Now. You know, the numbers started at 1,300 Israelis were killed in that Hamas attack, over 200 hostages taken. At this point, the number of Palestinians killed is something like well over 4,000. And again, the ground invasion has not started. Now, you may have followed the controversy this last week. Much of the Western mainstream media Wednesday was focused on who is responsible for that horrific explosion at the Al-Ahli Hospital in northern Gaza, which killed hundreds of people. The attention was directed less at the carnage in the hospital. Given the apparent scale of the explosion, responsibility was first widely believed to lie with Israel. which has a vast arsenal with numerous types of bombs, missiles, and other munitions. While en route to Israel, President Biden and Western mainstream media almost immediately embraced the Israeli military's explanation that the explosion was caused by an errant Palestinian Islamic Jihad missile. Al Jazeera contended something else. An organization called Forensic Architecture started to document everything. It is not clear what exactly happened in that particular case. As we watched on CNN, the pictures that the Israeli military provided of the trajectory of the missile and whether it was shot down from above and whether it was, you know, it was just an errant missile, I couldn't help but think of Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, right before the invasion of Iraq, who went before the UN Security Council. His voice had enormous power because he'd been dragging his feet on the war to the horror of Rumsfeld and President George W. Bush. So they had him be the one to deliver the message that Saddam Hussein did have weapons of mass destruction. One of the things that was played to prove al-Ahli was hit by an errant Palestinian Islamic Jihad missile was a conversation between militants. They said they'd captured in some kind of phone call. And I couldn't help but think about what Colin Powell played at that time. He said this conversation, these voices were proof that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And they had photographs they were showing of trucks being moved. This led up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq that has killed so many thousands of people, so many innocent civilians, even though the world rocked, or I should say, people all over the globe, millions marched in February 2003 for peace. They rocked the globe for peace. That voice of Colin Powell at the UN Security Council prevailed, and President Bush would bomb Iraq, invade Iraq in March of 2003. In fact, Rashid Khalidi, I just heard him say that he thinks it's much more relevant to talk about the Iraq war when we're looking at what's happening now in Israel and Palestine, then 9/11. So Colin Powell, the late Colin Powell, would later say that that speech he gave in February of 2003 was a stain on his career. He said he had been given false intelligence. We spoke to his aides who said he was horrified by what he had done, paving the way for war. I don't know what happened at al-Ahli. That still has yet to be fully determined or proven. But what I do know is that lower third that appeared almost for 24 hours straight on CNN that said Israel is not responsible. It would say sources say, U.S. Intel says, Israel is not responsible. I know that what was forgotten on that day, as President Biden flew in and embraced Netanyahu and embraced President Herzog, Arab leaders canceling their summit in rage, I know it wasn't talked about that day. The thousands of Palestinians already killed, separate from al-Ahli, by the more than 10 days at that point of the Israeli bombardment, and the unknown number buried alive or dead beneath the rubble. So we talked to Mustafa Barghouti. He is a Palestinian physician, general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. He said the atrocities are beyond description. We're subjected now as Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but also the West Bank, horrifying war crimes, ethnic cleansing, acts of collective punishment against the population of Gaza, where civilians are dying because they don't have water, electricity, don't have food, don't have medicine, an active genocide. Every 5 minutes, a Palestinian is killed in Gaza. Every 15 minutes, a Palestinian child is killed in Gaza. And it goes on, he said. Across the Arab world, as well as in the United States and Europe, the protests are mounting. From Ramallah in the occupied West Bank to Amman, Jordan, to Baghdad, Iraq, from Tunisia to Turkey, but also at the U.S. Capitol in the Cannon Rotunda. There, a Jewish-led protest organized by the groups If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace brought thousands out to demand a ceasefire. 300 protesters were arrested inside the rotunda. A number of rabbis were leading the protest. Did we hear them one after another, not just the faraway image of the rotunda, which was impressive, but hear their voices, why they felt this way as U.S., as Jewish U.S. citizens, what they were demanding of their elected leaders. Among those who attended the D.C. protest was Amira Haas, the renowned Israeli Jewish journalist with Haaretz, who's lived in the occupied territories for decades. She's the only Israeli Jewish journalist to live in Gaza and Ramallah for some 30 years. She wrote Drinking the Sea at Gaza, in Gaza. And she wrote the foreword and afterword to a book by her mother, Anna Levy. Her name is Hannah Levy Haas. It's a Holocaust memoir of her time in Bergen-Belsen. Yes, Amira is the daughter, the only daughter, the only child of Holocaust survivors, her mother and her father. I introduced her by saying she was covering the protest in Washington. I mean, she's usually in Ramallah, and she corrected me. She said, no, I wasn't covering it. I was part of the protest, she said, as a Jew, not as a journalist. This pounding of Gaza, it has to be stopped right now, she said. Not far from that protest came a protest from another quarter that is quietly gaining strength, and you should all pay attention. It's from inside the U.S. State Department. Josh Paul served for 11 years as the Director of Congressional and Public Affairs Bureau of Political Military Affairs. This is a government office most directly involved with the delivery of weapons to foreign governments. On Wednesday, Josh Paul wrote a two-page resignation letter, which he shared publicly online, and I will quote at length. This is a man who's been part of the establishment for over 11 years, particularly involved with buying weapons or with the purchase of and sending weapons abroad. He has resigned. He said, we cannot be both against occupation and for it. We cannot be both for freedom and against it. We cannot be for a better world while contributing to one that is materially worse. I believe to the core of my soul that the response Israel is taking, and with it the American support both for that response and for the status quo of the occupation, will only lead to more and deeper suffering for both the Israeli and the Palestinian people, and is not in the long-term American interest. This administration's response is immensely disappointing and entirely unsurprising. Josh Paul wrote, decades of the same approach have shown that security for peace leads to neither security nor to peace. There is beauty to be found elsewhere, everywhere in this world, and it deserves both protection and the right to flourish, and that is what I most desire for Palestinians and for Israelis. The murder of civilians is an enemy to that desire, whether by terrorists as they dance at a rave or by terrorists as they harvest their olive grove. The kidnapping of children is an enemy to that desire, whether taken at gunpoint from their kibbutz or taken at gunpoint from their village. And collective punishment is an enemy to that desire, whether it involves demolishing one home or 1,000, as too is ethnic cleansing, as too is occupation, as too is apartheid, he said. That was Josh Paul resigning his high-level State Department post after more than a decade. The saving of Israeli lives is intimately connected to the saving of Palestinian lives. We must value all life. And as journalists, the way we do that in our grassroots news organizations is by letting them be heard. And that is your power. That is what you're facilitating happening all over this country, whatever role you're in the independent grassroots media movement. Yes, it's our job to go to where the silence is, and it's often not silent there. Oh, it doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen, but it's often raucous, it is loud, it is people wailing It is people laughing. It is people demanding. We have to put our mics there. We have to be there. That is media serving a democratic society. Now, Trey talked about the work that Democracy Now! And before that, the work that I did at WBAI around East Timor. And I really wanted to end with this story. It is so important that we show up, that we cover, especially what, as Americans, we don't see at the other end, for example, of a U.S. weapon. And that's what brought us to East Timor. I went there with my colleague Alan Nairn first in 1990. East Timor is a tiny, at the time, occupied country, half of an island, about 300 miles above Australia. It was occupied by Indonesia in 1975. Now, I want to make one comment from Israel to Indonesia. Often, people are afraid to criticize the actions of the Israeli state because they will be smeared with the epithet, or what their criticism is will be described as anti-Semitic. I am very sensitive to anti-Semitism, and it is extremely serious in the world. But when you are criticizing the Israeli state, that is not anti-Semitic. And when we covered Indonesia and criticized the Indonesian state, Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, it is not anti-Muslim. We are describing what a state with the full power of its military at the time, Indonesia had the fourth most powerful military on earth. It is absolutely critical that criticism is not silenced when you're falsely accused of being Islamophobic or anti-Semitic. That's just a way to prevent you from speaking about the reality of the actions of a state. So Indonesia invaded East Timor December 7th, 1975. It was a day after Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who just turned 100 years old, feted all over the country as an elder statesman, asked the people of Chile whether he should be feted as an elder statesman or whether he should be tried as a war criminal for Henry Kissinger and President Nixon's support of the coup against the democratically elected leader of Chile, Salvador Allende, September 11, 1973, another September 11th, almost exactly 50 years ago. So Henry Kissinger and President Ford went to Indonesia and met with the murderous dictator Suharto. As they flew out to meet with another dictator, it was Fernando Marcos in the Philippines, Suharto invaded East Timor by land, by air, and by sea. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. Kissinger and Ford had given the green light for that invasion. And I could only think about what happened with Israel when President Biden, the first president to go to a wartime Israel, personally visited. And we got the reporting from HuffPost and other places that those within the State Department who were using words like de-escalation were to stop. And when the readout was done of President Biden's phone call with Netanyahu right before he went to Israel, the White House made a point of saying he did not use the word restraint. So Ford and Kissinger gave the green light in that case, left, and Suharto invaded East Timor by land, by air, and by sea, 90% of the weapons from the United States. It was a brutal invasion they occupied for almost two decades. They killed a third of the population of East Timor. It was one of the worst genocides of the late 20th century. My colleague, a very brave journalist, Alan Naren, and I got to go in 1990, and what we found was a true hell on earth. Indonesia occupied every space in East Timor. People were being dragged out of their homes in the middle of the night, disappeared, killed. We went back in the fall of 1991 because for the first time, the UN was going to send a delegation to investigate what was happening in East Timor. It was a Portuguese parliamentary delegation. Portugal had occupied Timor for decades, but they'd pulled out in 1974, and then Indonesia invaded. We got to Timor. We went to the main Catholic church in Dili. Timor is a Catholic country. And during the service, the women started to wail. And we didn't know if it was just the common sorrow of Timor or if something had just happened. And afterwards, we learned that the Indonesian military had surrounded the church and killed a young man who was taking refuge there. His name was Sebastio Gomez. His blood was still fresh on the steps of the Motael church. So what was happening was the delegation was going to come. And we learned that the Indonesian military had issued a nationwide death threat against the people of Timor. You will not speak to that delegation. And so people dropped out of their workplaces, their schools, their regular lives to take refuge in the churches. It was the one place that Indonesia had not yet invaded, the Catholic churches. And they were taking refuge because they wanted to speak to the delegation to talk about what was happening in East Timor, their first chance to get word out to an official UN delegation. And Sebastio was one of those in this church, and he was shot at point-blank range. And so the next day was the funeral, and we covered this funeral. People incredibly brave, 1,000 people followed the family carrying the coffin. They didn't know Sebastio, but they knew what a violation this was of their church, of the continued threat to their freedom. And they marched to the Santa Cruz Cemetery, and there they buried him. And then we heard, as we traveled around Timor, that there was going to be a two-week commemoration procession for Sebastio. And we went to the Motael Church 2 weeks later, and there were so many people who came out to the church for the 6 a.m. Mass that the priests had to come outside to perform the service, to hold Mass. And then people took to the streets and they unfurled banners that they had stuffed into their Catholic school blouses that said things like, why the Indonesian military shoot our church. They appealed to President Bush, that was George H.W. Bush at the time. Please do something about this. They appealed to the United Nations and they marched. Thousands of people, their hands up in the V sign. Viva East Timor, Viva Sebastio, Viva Independence, they chanted. Incredibly brave as the Indonesian military lined the streets. They marched to the cemetery. Alan and I were following them, talking to people. When we got to the cemetery, there were high walls on either side of the road for the cemetery. And so the people could only escape if they went through a tiny opening in the wall. And we would say, why are you doing this? I mean, the Indonesian military has killed so many hundreds of thousands of people. And they'd say, for my mother, for my father, for my cousin who was killed, my whole village was wiped out. And they would say things like that. And then we saw from the direction the procession was coming from, hundreds of Indonesian soldiers marching up with their US M16s at the ready position. People could escape the walls on either side of the road. We were talking to people at the back, and we always hid our equipment because anyone caught talking to a Western journalist, they too could be disappeared. So this time we took out our equipment. I slung my bag over my shoulder. I held out my tape recorder and I held up my microphone like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head and we walked to the front of the crowd. Indonesian soldiers were marching up 10 to 12 abreast, US M16s at the ready position. They swept around the corner. They swept past us. And without any warning, without any hesitation, without any provocation, they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. A little boy behind us with his hands up in the V sign exploded before our eyes. A group of soldiers came then at us. One threw me to the ground. They were beating me. Alan took a picture of them at first, opening fire. Then he threw himself on top of me to protect me from further injury. And they took their US M16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull. A group of them stood in front of us in firing squad fashion, put the guns to our heads. We had nothing now. They had stripped us of everything. But I had my passport, and I threw it at them as they were shouting, "Australia, Australia." They were asking if we were from Australia. We knew what had happened to Australian journalists 17 years before, right before Indonesia invaded East Timor. They were from they were in a town called Balibo. Oh, Greg Shackleton, Australian Broadcasting Corporation, another ABC, and other journalists. And they had lined them up against a house, and they had executed them. The person in charge of that execution later became Indonesia's Minister of Information. So we knew what had happened to those journalists. And as we lay on the ground, Alan covered in blood, we shouted back, "No, America, America." At some point, they took the guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from, and they would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese, and they moved on. We were able to get into a Red Cross Jeep that had bravely driven up, and then dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us, on top of the Jeep, and we drove as a human mass to the hospital. They were trying to escape the massacre scene. At the hospital, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us, when they saw Alan dripping with blood, because of how the Timorese see us. And I don't just mean Timorese or just us. I mean how people in the world see people from the United States. They see us in two ways, as the shield and the sword. The shield, because when the American people speak up, we can have an effect on our government, if people know. And the sword, because all too often the U.S. provides weapons to human rights abusing regimes. On that day, they saw that shield bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. We left the hospital. It was clear this would be a place that the Indonesian military would probably go after where surviving Timorese were, and we had to get word out. We went to the compound of the Timorese bishop, Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello, who would later win the Nobel Peace Prize with, well, the now President José Ramos Horta, who I just saw in New York at the UN General Assembly. We went to Bishop Bello's compound. Thousands of Timorese were taking refuge there. I think about that as I think of the thousands of Palestinians who are taking refuge in schools, in hospitals, and how they're being bombed. In the case of Gaza, the Israeli government tells them to move south. They move south, and then they are bombed as they move to places like Khan Yunis and other places. But I, in that compound then with Bishop Bello, Alan again dripping with blood, we knew the only way to stop this killing is if we could get word out. And we figured we had to get to the airport. There was one plane out that day. Bishop Bello gave Alan a shirt. We were cleaning off his neck. I took Alan's bloodied shirt and I wrapped it around my skirt under a towel he had given us. So at least I would have evidence if he denied that a massacre had taken place. And then we went out onto the road, and we knew if it was an Indonesian taxi cab driver, they cleared the roads now, so very few cars were there. Tanks had rolled through the streets, or jeeps of soldiers. But a Timorese driver picked us up, and we said, to the airport quickly. And we raced to the airport, and when we got there, we went up to the counter and said, we have to get on that plane, the one plane out that day. And they started to yell, shout. We had cleaned them up enough to know, because we didn't want them to see we were at the massacre site. Either they would deny us, or if they had actually decided not to kill us, they would want us to get out of the country. And so, as the only thing I had left, we couldn't go back to the hotel, they'd already overrun it, were my one ticket in my pocket, and they were throwing it around. They were waving it in the air, shouting at each other, going behind the counter, coming back, going into an office, coming back. But they decided that they would let us get on that plane. And so we walked on the tarmac, accompanied by a soldier. Alan was having electrical charges through his body from the beating. They had fractured his skull using the US M16s as bats against his skull. And I didn't want them to see how slowly he was walking, so I kept stopping next to him and saying, what a beautiful country. We will be back soon. What a beautiful country. We got into the plane, and as they closed the doors, the Indonesian flight attendants gave me a silver bowl of water, and they said, clean him. We flew on to West Timor and then to Bali, and we tried to get onto a plane. It was Continental Airlines at the time, and the top executive was saying we were not allowed on that plane because we were such a mess. The U.S. Consul representative in Bali was there. He was a music teacher. And he said, we're going to get them on that plane. And they wrapped us in blankets. They brought us on the plane. Alan couldn't sit down. He asked if he could be tied to the side of the plane. And when they closed the doors of this plane, the flight attendants asked on the plane if there were any doctors in the house for Alan. Doctors were helping him on the plane. They came from the U.S. Naval Base at Guam, and they said they were going to have an ambulance from the military hospital. But we said no. We wanted to go to the provincial hospital of Guam because we were afraid the U.S. military, who had so allied itself with so long with the Indonesian military, would prevent us from communicating. The whole point we had to get out of the country. We'd made one call out in Bali. And as Alan spoke on the phone, I took the towel and I would wipe the blood off the phone as he called back into the United States and said there's been a massacre. You know, the military denied a massacre had taken place, and then they had to admit maybe a few people, then maybe dozens of people, then ultimately hundreds of people. Of course, they had killed over 270 Timorese on that day, and that was not one of the larger massacres in East Timor. We got to the United States, we went directly to Washington. And when Alan got out of the hospital the next day, we held a news conference saying the weapons were used. The weapons used were from the United States. As people heard around the world the massacre that had taken place, a global movement grew up against the occupation of East Timor, the illegal occupation of East Timor. In 1999, the people of East Timor got to vote for their freedom. The UN sponsored a referendum after mass protests around the world, and they voted overwhelmingly for their freedom. The UN ran the transition for 3 years. Sergio de Mello was the UN representative who oversaw that transition. And you may remember that Sergio de Mello was one of the UN officials who died in a bombing in Iraq. And in May of 2002, the Democratic Republic of East Timor was born. During the period of after the massacre of 1991, Alan and I were banned from entering East Timor. The Indonesian parliament held up pictures of us and said we would not be allowed to come into the country. But on that day, May 2002, I entered through Darwin, Australia. Alan made it to East Timor. And there with thousands of Timorese, right at midnight, with a fireworks display, Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, who had been imprisoned for years by Indonesia, ascended the stage, the first president of Timor-Leste, that is East Timor, ascended the stage, and speaking in at least four languages, he unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. The fireworks display you could see reflected in the tear-stained faces of the people of East Timor. They had resisted and they had won at an unbelievably high price, but they had prevailed. And they thanked people all over the world who stood up for them, who ensured that they could arrive at this day, though so many, a third of the population, could not. And it was a lesson to all of us, whether we are journalists or farmers, whether we are doctors, nurses, teachers, artists, whether we're employed or unemployed. We have a decision to make every day, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now!
That was Amy Goodman speaking last week in Charleston, West Virginia at the Grassroots Radio Coalition annual gathering. And you heard it here on Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN now broadcasting at 91.9 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and we'll keep following this story and others. I hope to see you again next week for another edition. Take care.